Welcome to CCC's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, March 22nd, 2024. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Executive Editor, joins me today from New York City. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
A Virginia county school system has suspended a reading program of Catherine Applegate's Wish Tree. Tell us why.
Yeah, so this is a really wild story from Floyd County, Virginia, that would be funny if it wasn't, you know, really happening. You know, as you point out, the Floyd County Public Schools in Virginia have suspended a one division, as in a school division, a one division, one book community reading of Catherine Applegate's Wish Tree, following complaints that the middle grade novel depicts a monoecious red oak, which is a tree with reproductive parts that can both pollinate and flower simultaneously. So you can see where this is going, right? In the book, which was originally published in, I think, 2017 by Macmillan, the tree claims that it's both female and male and responds to diverse pronouns. Call me she, call me he, anything will work, the book says. And, well, we know how that's going to fly in today's book banning environment, right? The school kicked off its reading program, and almost immediately on March 4th, a parent in another district whose children apparently attend a private Christian academy in another county took to social media to rally Floyd County residents against the book and its reference to gender, calling Wish Tree's non-binary account of the oak tree's identity, and I'll quote this here, indoctrination at its finest. That, of course, led to an email from school officials noting concern over the book, again, which is about a tree, and informing the community that it was going to cancel the one division, one book reading. Now, the question is why specifically? And it seems like school board officials really don't want to say why specifically. Our reporter, Natalie Optebeck, was told by one school board official that the district would be able to give her more information about the cancellation. However, school officials did not return calls, so not really surprised, but certainly not eager to talk about this. The author, however, did respond, telling Natalie that, you know, her first reaction was to laugh because this seems like satire, something like coming from The Onion, she said. But of course, there really is nothing funny about the real motivation, the author said, which, of course, is bigotry against LGBTQ people. The author expressed disappointment that the one division, one book and its inclusion of Wish Tree were dismissed with no explanations and nothing concrete from the school district. And I think this is a really good point, because this is the kind of thing that is happening in many communities and isn't always reported. Like, for example, in the ALA's data on book challenges, which we talked about last week, we only can report the challenges that we hear of. And these are the kinds of things that happen all the time, where school boards or other officials are simply pulling books with no process, no community input. Often this is the result of complaints by organized groups, or in many cases, a single person. And the threat is, you know, always the same, which is, you know, not to, you know, challenge the book through the established process, but to, you know, sort of shout them out of existence. Either pull this book or we will be showing up at your school board meeting and, you know, calling you groomers on social media. Anyway, you can read the entire story on the PW site. It's one of several in recent days that show how, you know, 3 years into this thing now, the surge in book bans is not only not slowing down, but it's reaching what are, you know, sometimes some pretty absurd new heights.
PW also covered reports from New York City involving discarded books found near a public school.
Yeah, another example of how book bans are happening outside of the traditional processes. And again, we talked about the ALA's recent data on book bans last week, which tracks challenges that are reported either directly to ALA or to the media. And of course, that's only a fraction of the book banning that's actually likely going on, because as this case illustrates, this happened on Staten Island, which is a very conservative borough here in the city. No one would have found out about this if it wasn't discovered by a reporter, right? So, you know, what's this all about? Well, on March 11th, a reporter for Gothamist wrote about hundreds of new books featuring characters of color and LGBTQ themes were found near the garbage at PS 55 in Staten Island. Now, some of the books pictured in the report were marked by sticky notes, and those notes said not approved or had a reason for like having the book thrown out, such as boy questions gender, Or teenage girls having crush on another girl in class. One note said witchcraft. So Gothamist reporter Jessica Gold did some digging and found out that indeed there was no due process here. There were no formal challenges to the books that were apparently being thrown away. This has now been raised through official channels that the removal of these books was apparently the result of an objection. And this is cagey. The school district said was the result of an objection by a staff member or by parents. Well, which is it? We should be able to see the objection. There should be a form. There is no form. The New York City Department of Education has reportedly since announced that it will be conducting an investigation into the incident. And in response, a coalition of publishers whose books were, you know, among those discarded, have teamed up with the newly formed group Authors Against Book Bans, which you can read about on the PW site. We had a feature on the group last week, to pen a letter to New York City's Department of Education about the book removal, stating that, and I'll quote the letter here, if true, such actions amount to unlawful censorship and violates authors' and students' First Amendment rights. So it's going to be interesting to see what this investigation concludes, and we'll be keeping an eye on it here at PW. But again, another example, or so it appears, of how censorship efforts in many communities sometimes unfold.
HarperCollins executives traveled from last week's London Book Fair to Rome, where they met one of their authors.
Yeah, you can see the picture on the PW site. They met with the Pope, with Pope Francis. The Pope had a new book come out with HarperCollins last week. It's called Life. It's apparently not a memoir. I haven't had a chance to look through it yet, but it is the Pope looking back on his life through history. But kind of a big deal, right? I mean, we've seen publishing leaders pretty regularly meet with world leaders and presidents. In fact, kind of happens all the time, right? Publishers sign and edit presidents. And I've seen quite a few of those photos and quite a few of those partnerships. But I really can't recall a publisher in my lifetime getting an audience at the Vatican with the Pope. Pretty rare. And I think it makes this photo of HarperCollins leaders pretty extraordinary. The delegation in the photo includes Harper One publisher Judith Kerr, CEO Brian Murray, Chantal Restivo-Alessi, who's the chief digital officer, and I believe the international publisher at HarperCollins now, and Laura Danini, who's the managing director of HarperCollins Italia. The Pope signed books for each HarperCollins division that took part in the one-day laydown. I think there's eight divisions, so I think he signed eight books. And Kerr told Jim Milliot that the Pope was into it. So, you know, a pretty cool moment, I think, for HarperCollins leaders after the London Book Fair.
Sybil Steinberg, a Publishers Weekly editor for 25 years, died on March 17th at 90.
Yes, sad news for us at PW and I think for the industry this week. Sybil Steinberg, who was iconic in her day and in a way that I don't think anyone really will ever be in this business again, if I'm being honest, given the current media landscape and the rise of social media. Sybil passed away on March 17th at the age of 90. Sybil was an influencer. She was the original influencer. She was someone who, as publishers would call in our obituary that's in the magazine on Monday, someone who could make a book. And she was also known to throw a little fire from time to time, too. And what a story of her own, right? She graduated from Smith College in 1954, where she edited the Sophia student newspaper. And she turned down an entry-level job at Doubleday in favor of marriage and starting a family. And for two decades, that's what she did. She was a wife and mother to three in Westport. And, you know, she started writing articles for the PTA and then the local paper, and then a stint at the famous Writers School, which some of our readers might remember as a correspondence course that was founded by, among others, Bennett Cerf. And it was there that she met Jean Mercier, who was the children's book editor at PW, who asked Steinberg to write a review, which led to a fill-in copy editing role, and then regular reviews for PW. And by 1979, Sybil Steinberg was the fiction editor and soon began overseeing all of PW's author interviews as well. As the fiction reviews editor, Sybil introduced the Boxed Review to Publishers Weekly to highlight promising new talent. And she selected Amy Tan's debut novel, The Joy Luck Club, as the first Boxed Review. And Sybil went on to profile virtually all the greats over her career. Tons of amazing authors, some of the most elite literary talents out there, with a crowning achievement, I think, coming when Pantheon invited her to London in 1994 to interview Salman Rushdie, who was still in hiding 6 years after the fatwa had been issued over the Satanic Verses. Michael Coffey, who retired as co-editorial director of PW in 2014, recalls that extraordinary assignment as a testament to the trust and the respect that Sybil was accorded from the highest levels of American publishing. After her retirement from PW in 2001, Steinberg continued to review books and maintain her ties to the publishing industry. And she was always revered in the hallways here at Publishers Weekly. And, you know, I never really got to know Sybil very well. The times that I did meet her, she was exceedingly kind to me. She was a class act all the way. So, yes, a very sad week for us here at PW and, of course, for the Steinberg family. So our condolences to them. And in Monday's issue, we have a really great tribute to Sybil Steinberg. So definitely check that out. It's a great read, and it really does cover a remarkable publishing career.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly Executive Editor, thanks for joining me today with your reporting and editorial analysis.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on CCC's podcast, Book Industry Study Group Executive Director Brian O'Leary shares details on BISG's recent initiative to forge a shared vision for the future of supply chain communication in publishing. Improvements in this area, he asserts, can directly lead to more reliable forecasting.
BISG has been involved in a project going back about 2 years now to improve forecasting. And I think the data repositories and kind of a supply chain model of the sort that we're imagining would be much more effective in informing not just publishers, but the balance of the supply chain on what's happening and what they can reasonably plan for. So forecasting would improve significantly.
That's all for now. Our producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to Velocity of Content wherever you go for podcasts, and don't miss an episode of the show. The CCC podcast is also available on the CCC YouTube channel. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for joining me.